No, go right ahead. Do you know that they make tapes now too, but make your own.
Mm-hmm.
You can make your own, either way.
Okay.
Yeah, see, they're recording this. Okay. Shalom. It's good to see a good group. Some of you haven't been here for a year. You're welcome back. Some of you are old faithful from last year. Some of you are new faces. You're all welcome. The rubrics are simple. This is free and without obligation, like the gospel itself. And we will translate the texts for you, in a sense. If you want to come and just listen, come and follow along. If you want to prepare, I mean, the more you put in, the more you get out. But there's no requirement. This is purely voluntary. And that's the way it should be, I think. The procedure is to, if you don't recall or don't know, is to work 10 days in advance. So the lessons we're doing today are the lessons not for this coming Sunday, but for a week from Sunday, whatever that is, the 20-somethings. After what Sunday is it after Pentecost? We should know this. I forgot. We're only 15, whatever. It's always X number after Pentecost. 15 Sunday after Pentecost, Proverbs 25. We'll try to start with the Old Testament text and work till about 5 after 12, and then that'll divide it up to give the second half to the Gospel. Though that varies a little bit with the length of the reading. If you've noticed, the Proverbs 25 text is relatively short, so I'm vamping a little bit here because I don't have much to talk about. You can certainly ask questions or engage us afterwards. The other thing we're going to do a little bit differently this year is spread the wealth around, which will spare you a steady diet of Veltz and Bartelt. Though I will probably take the lead with Old Testament, we're trying to involve also some more of our own colleagues in this endeavor. And you will see Robbie and Schriever take their turns, as well as Professor Gibbs really taking over the mainstay for Professor Veltz on the New Testament side, though I'm sure Veltz will make his presence known. It is inevitable. Proverbs 25, then, if I can find it, remembering that all these books are in a different place. They got it all messed up when they translated into Greek. And, of course, the English followed the Greek. What is this, verses 6 and 7? Now, a little bit eisegogics, I suppose. We're starting a new section of the book of Proverbs with chapter 25. Gam Elah, I'm reading verse 1. Gam Elah, also these two, are Mishlei Shlomo, which were copied, which the men of Hezekiah copied down. So you have this tradition of wisdom going on beyond Solomon, and here connected to Hezekiah, who was one of the better, if not one of the few good, kings of Judah. And this seems to be its own collection. Of course, you know, who knows how all of this really came to be in terms of collecting these things, but you have at least another collection of Proverbs here accredited to the men of Hezekiah. They collected them. They didn't generate them, but kind of collected them. Then sort of an introductory word, I suppose, on how you handle Proverbs in general and wisdom literature, which, for the most part, is little more than common sense, not necessarily sanctified common sense. But just as the rain falls upon the just and on the unjust, so popular wisdom seems to work whether you're a Christian or not. And what makes this distinctively biblical in its revelation? Well, I think to one degree one would have to say not much at all, you see, unless one understands that everything is under God. Whether you're a Christian or not, the ways of the world still work because, after all, the Creator made it that way. This is what we call, in a sense, natural law or natural revelation, and is sort of first article stuff. And it's kind of interesting, you know, that when you think about it, when we talk about first article, we're already talking Christian creedal confessions, but there is such a thing as sort of a first article deist who ain't necessarily a Christian. CF most of the founding fathers of this country, right? Now, I don't want to editorialize, but in our world today, I'd love to see a couple of deists. You know, give me a good old-time first article deist. That's at least already one step further than nothing. I don't want to get lost in the whole church-state issue, but there's a lot of grist for the mill here. Now, of course, one who understands the second article comes back to a lot of the first article stuff with a new attitude. And in this sense, some of the third article stuff begins to overlap with the first article stuff, that the first use of the law comes full circle, and we call it the third use of the law. It's just that we're doing it because we understand the gospel. And that puts in a different context, you see. And I think that's the way we look at a lot of this, quote, wisdom literature, is that it is sort of common sense. Whether you're Ben Franklin or a contemporary Christian, it makes sense and it works, right? But we still see things differently, not only because we see things under God, but we see all things through Christ. And the second article kind of holds the whole creed together from the middle out. That's just a little theological comment on a way of getting to this. How does this apply in homiletics? Well, I suppose, you know, it's hard to preach a sermon on some common sense stuff like don't sit at the front because you might be embarrassed, which is essentially all this text says, except that a couple of things happen. One, like I said, we see this as something that has to do with how God made the world to work. We understand all things through Christ, who himself was a model of humility, and one certainly can pick up on that theme, not to mention that our Lord himself picked this text, so to speak, as his text for the parable that is the gospel. Right? And here's a clear case where the lectionary has helpfully paired the Old Testament lesson with the gospel, which is really the agenda anyway. Well, let's look at the text here. You almost have to get a little bit of a running start because this is addressed to kings, if you will. I'll read verse 2 just to set the context here. The Kavod Elohim, it is the glory of God, haster, to hide a thing, a davar. It is the glory of kings to understand a word. Now, this is just an interesting line in and of itself. You sort of have, it's God's business to befuddle. This is the Deus absconditus, or the mystery of God. Not to befuddle as much as to be recognized as something ultimately beyond human comprehension. But it's the business of the king to make sense out of things. Now, understand, remember, that the king stands for more than just the government, but in a monarchy, the king is also the patron of almost all what we would call humanities and liberal arts projects, NEH stuff, okay? So what the king is about also has to do with universities, with sort of the intelligentsia, with the patron of the arts, all generally known in the Old Testament as wise men. More wisdom stuff, okay? But this is subsidized heavily by the court, and you don't have it unless at least in sort of in a an organized way. So this is sort of saying, look, best we can, it's the job of humanity to try to make sense out of the world, yet recognizing, and I think this is the context in which all of these proverbs now are put in this section, that it's the business of God, or it's the kavod Elohim, to keep certain things hidden. So try as you want, you're never going to understand it all anyway. But that doesn't mean you don't try to make sense out of reality. But ultimately, ultimate sense, whether it's common sense or divinely revealed sense, comes from God. All right, now we get to verse 6. Al tith hadar lifnei melech. Al plus the imperfect, a little grammatical review, is the normal way of giving a negative command. Remember, you don't use an imperative form, you use opus the imperfect. Now, you've got to be excited right off the bat with a hith pael. What more could you want? Huh? Our first verb to parse of the new year, and it's a hith pael. Of hadar, which means to be glorious or to make something glorious, or in the hith pael, to make yourself glorious. Kind of a boast word, all right? So do not make yourself glorious. I can't think of a good paraphrase. Maybe you can help me here. Lifne melech, before a king. Do not, strut your stuff? Put on airs. Not bad. Who said that? That's good. Put on airs. Kind of, try to be a big shot. And b'makom gidolim al ta'amoz. Hey, you can actually translate this. B'makom, preposition, in, construct chain, a place of gidolim, big guys. All right? We might say big shots. Great ones. Do not, al, again the same idiom, al plus the imperfect, do not ta'amoz, do not stand. All right? Stand here in the sense not just of get up, but sort of take position, you see. Now, we all know people like this, right? Who, when they enter a room, want people to notice them. Right? And I guess that's the obvious application, whether this be a party. But even more so, remember, the context here is that of the action of the court. And entering the king's presence is always one of what should be a rather humble nature. And, of course, I'm sure there were guys who were not. Verse 7. Ki tov amar laka alehena. Ki tov. For good it is. That's really a nonverbal sentence. Good it is. Amar laka. Now, amar is the infinitive construct of amar. You learn the infinitive construct in the katol form, schwa holam, and that's what you've got here, a schwa followed by, and name that vowel, o vowel, reduced to the short vowel, comets katuf, looks the same as a comet, because it's proclitic, it's attached to laka, with that makeif always makes it unaccented. So you have a closed syllable, short vowel, the long vowel. All of that just to remind you, this is the normal vowel pointing of an infinitive construct, katol. To say to you, get it? It is good, for it is good to say to you, alay, imperative of Allah, all third hays have imperatives with saray, hey, come up, the imperative, come up, hena is that hither word, to here, hither. I'd still like to reinstate hither, thither, and yon. I've always thought those were nice words. It is good to say to you, come up here, may hashpilaka. Now, you got to take this apart, take the min off. May is min, remember, it attaches itself as a prefix. So that's the preposition from hashpilaka. Hashpil, you want to parse this? You should be able to parse it even if you don't know the verb. It is hifil infinitive construct, right by the book. Shafal is the root. Now, shafal means to be low. It's the opposite of Allah. Allah is to go up. Shafal is to be low. The shefilah is a geographical term, is the descending plane from the western ridge down to the sea of to the Mediterranean Sea. That's called the shefilah. It's the same word, to be low. So in the hifil, it means cause to be low. So, to cause you to be low. Get it? The object suffix, aka. Now, what's the force of the min here? Remember this idiom? Min is used here as comparison of adjectives. Good from equals better than. Now you put it all together and you got the verse. Because it is better to say to you, come up here, than to put you low. Then to send you down, lifnei nadiv, before a nadiv. This is a parallel, a poetic parallel to Melech at the beginning of the verse, I suspect. A Nadiv, no one knows what this is. It means probably a wealthy patron. Again, would that we had dictionary definitions for all social structure words, but we don't. The verb Nadav means to volunteer, and etymology is risky business, especially about the history of words. But it could mean something about one who, you know, had enough leisure time to, you know, sort of like people in Ladue that do nothing but go to charity auctions or something like that. Your sort of leisure class. But in that sense, sort of a general word for noble, rich person, the kind of guy who'd be dining at the king's court, you know, after 18 holes at the club. So this sort of thing. Now, again, the wisdom of this verse is sort of self-evident, right? Be humble, and it's a little bit better for someone to invite you higher than to kick you off the dias when you don't belong there. There you have it. The only other problem with this verse, of course, is the next three words, Asherau Aneka, which the Masoretes have included in verse 7. It doesn't fit very well, but I have at least some sympathy for the Masoretes. How do we handle this? Then to be put down before a noble whom your eyes have seen would be what you'd have to do with this relative clause. In which case, it's sort of talking about the further embarrassment of actually being in the presence of somebody. You know, you've been there, you've sort of made visual contact with them, you've thought yourself worthy of their presence, and they've seen who you are, which only makes it more embarrassing to get kicked out. You see, it's better if they didn't even see you or you hadn't seen them. Both the Masoretic text editor, not the Masoretic text, the BHS text editors and most English translations put the Asher clause with the next verse. And you'll see that here's a good case where English Bibles will be strikingly different depending on where you divide these verses. Okay, and they'll put it with the next verse, what your eyes have seen, do not go out into judgment quickly, la rive to bear a lawsuit. Making the next proverb say something like, after you've seen something, don't jump right to court with it. You might think about the consequences first, which is putting it on the next one. Again, I think there's some wisdom to what the Masoretes have done, and one could certainly make sense out of the Asher clause with the previous. Not that this makes a whole lot of difference. I think this adds a little bit more nuance to the embarrassment of being put down low. Any questions here? We want to quit and get to the Greek now, and it wasn't much, but yeah, John. Well, it makes sense out of that. I mean, oh yeah, it could, but I don't. How does that help here? Yeah, I think you could defend that. To take the Asher as a more general statement, whatever your eyes have seen works well if you take it with the next line. And there are those who argue that that's not very good Hebrew. I don't buy that, but yeah. Well, homiletically, you can run in lots of directions. I mean, that's not necessarily the point here. Well, there's a quote you can take home. It's not the point of the text, but it's sure good for, yeah, it's, you know. How much of most sermons you could argue that. We'll let that stand till we look at the New Testament and see what Jesus does with this. Let's go, yeah.